We have a quorum. I'll call the meeting of the Higher Education Finance Committee to order. And for those of you with copies of the agenda, I just want to tell you that it's wrong. Well, it's been revised, but anyway. And so the first bill we'll hear today is 3268, then 3252, and then 3169. So that'll be the order. Representative Abrams?
Mr. Chairman, I move that House File 3268 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Jobs and Economic Development.
Right.
And
to begin your presentation.
Mr. Chairman, I do have an amendment to put the bill into the shape. I wish to at least take it on to the next stop, if the committee would indulge. If you go to Subdivision 3 of the bill at the end, on the back page, lines 6.4 to 6.18, the bill currently takes money just from the general fund, non-dedicated general fund. It was always the intention of this author and the university to identify a non-general fund source for a variety of reasons, and this would take amounts payable from the tobacco settlement and put that towards paying the bonds off that are in the bill. And if members will just put this amendment on, then I will explain it as we get to that portion of the bill. So I would move the amendment.
Any questions? Do we identify this amendment?
It's kind of a blank amendment on
just
top.
A blank. Okay. The blank amendment?
Yeah.
Okay, seeing no questions, all those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chairman and members, House File 3268 is probably one of the most forward-looking pieces of legislation that I've seen during my tenure in the legislature. It provides a framework for a biomedical science research funding program for the University of Minnesota. As President Brunigs will discuss at greater length, one of the issues in getting into bioscience research is that you are trying to attract the top researchers in the world in order to do some highly specialized research that will have enormous impact, hopefully, on Minnesota's economy and the health and welfare of everybody in the world. And that the way in which you attract some of these researchers is through facilities. Under the current system, the university is under the constraint of trying to attract people without having the building in place and going through a rather cumbersome and legislative process in order to get there. Under this bill, under Section 3, which is the guts of the bill, a Bioscience Research Authority is created, which has bonding authority up to, I believe, $340 million over a 10-year period for 10 buildings. The members of the authority would consist of the Commissioner of Employment and Economic Development, hence why the bill has to go to the Jobs Committee. It would include four other gubernatorial appointees and four legislative appointees. The legislative appointees for separation of powers, we have been told by bond counsel in the Attorney General's office, must be non-voting members. I'm going to turn this over. I also want to point out in Section 5 that it is not all these buildings would not necessarily be located on the campus in the Twin Cities. If you go to lines 5.5 to 5.8, I think there is an intention upon the university to be working collaboratively with Mayo Clinic in order for a facility to perhaps be located in Rochester. The way this operates is that there would be a bond authority that would take a request from the University of Minnesota dealing solely with biomedical science. There would be a 10% match by the University of Minnesota. And I think that the intent is probably one building every 2 years until 2015. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to get into the details of President Brennig's.
Welcome to the committee, and looking forward to your presentation.
Well, Chairman Norris, members of the committee, it's great to be back with you once again and to have a day with a little bit better weather. I was talking to Representative Cox about the difficulty of getting here the last time. I'd like to introduce two people as I begin, and that is Regent Stephen Hunter is with us and behind me. And I thought Regent Patty Simmons would join us, and she may join us later. I've asked Dr. Deborah Powell, who serves as the Dean of our medical school, to join us as well, and she may add some additional content to our discussion here this afternoon. I'd like to begin by making the case as to why this is an urgent need for Minnesota, why it's particularly important to the university and its position in our state, in our nation, I would argue even our global position, and then talk a little bit more about the details of the bill that Representative Abrams has presented to you this afternoon. I think we all recognize that Minnesota is a global leader in what we call the biomedical sciences in fields like medical devices, medical services, the broad areas of health and the health-related industries. And in Minnesota today, you will find more than 500 related companies and support organizations that employ more than 250,000 people in this particular sector. It's one of Minnesota's strongest sectors, with companies like 3M, Boston Scientific, Guidant, Medtronic, St. Jude Medical, and I could name many others that are obviously smaller and less visible. We've had 32% growth in employment in this particular business sector in Minnesota's economy in the past several years, compared to about a 10% increase in employment nationally. This is also an area where the University of Minnesota is a national and, I would argue, a global leader. We've invested several hundred million dollars in buildings and in academic investments in the biomedical sciences in the past several years. It remains as one of the top priorities of the university going forward. And it is an important investment for our state and the university for a number of reasons. This year, faculty and staff at the University of Minnesota will compete for and receive more than $560 million of competitive grants and contracts for research. That's 98% of all such money that comes through competitive grants and contracts into Minnesota's private and public systems of higher education. Of that total, more than $300 million comes from one source alone, the National Institutes of Health, and funds biomedical research. We think we're on the right path, and we think we've set the right priorities, but we lack, I think, the necessary infrastructure, as Representative Abrams has pointed out, to really continue our strong leadership in this area. Will Rogers once said, even if you think you're on the right track, you can simply get run over if you just sit there. And I think we are at a critical point in Minnesota, and we need to act and act now if we're going to advance the state's critical interest in this area. So why is it really important, and why do you need a different approach than the traditional bonding bill? Representative Abrams just pointed out that investment in this area requires continuity and it requires a long-term view. It often takes 2 to 3 years to recruit the people you need, and it clearly takes a longer-term time horizon to stay competitive in this area. This is a place where other states and other countries are making massive investments at the present time. And so there's a sense of urgency that we feel to meet and exceed the competition that is very active in the biomedical sciences. We think we can and should increase the level of funding in biomedical research that comes into Minnesota and comes into the University of Minnesota, and I would argue also Mayo Clinic. And then finally, this is an area where ideas create economic activity. And so this is an area where we need to be strong, where we need to create new discoveries, new ideas that can be transferred as technology into the economic marketplace to benefit our economy and quality of life. So we think it is important to view this as a long-term economic investment in Minnesota's economy and quality of life. The university must also maintain and increase its strength in this area. As I've indicated to you, as we've undertaken the strategic positioning of repositioning of the university, we've designated this as one of our long-term priorities. It's essential to expand the faculty and the related research staff in this particular area. We need, in order to do that, to develop technologically sophisticated research to support their work and also to recruit them. And we need to, as I indicated, strengthen our research funding and maintain our strength in this particular area. Why is it important relative to what other people are doing? And I want to just show you a quick map. These dots on the map show states that have very, very active programs of investment in the biomedical sciences, highly visible programs of investment. The one you've probably read the most about is the public referendum in California that created a $3 billion stem cell research initiative. But other states represented by these dots are also undertaking very significant investment at the present time. In Iowa, $700 million is being spent on economic development initiatives, much of it devoted to biomedical research. In Wisconsin, $750 million will be invested over the next several years, with over $500 million alone invested in new facilities to support biomedical research. States that are not even on the map in this area, Virginia, a state with great universities but not a strong position in the biomedical sciences, are going to invest more than $500 million. Indiana is a major initiative, and I could go on and on to explain the stories behind each one of these dots. What Representative Abrams has said and what I'm saying today is the state of Minnesota needs to develop a longer-term, more predictable plan for constructing these technologically sophisticated research laboratories and spaces. So what is the plan that we're bringing forward today? And I'll try to make it quick so we can have some time for discussion. This plan would construct, as Representative Abrams has noted, a building or the equivalent remodeling of a building every 2 years for the next 10 years. Each of these buildings would be approximately 150,000 assignable square feet, house about 160 researchers, 40 of them faculty, with probably three research staff per faculty member. We estimate that each of these researchers and their teams conservatively would generate about $370,000 per year in grant dollars, with a very substantial return on investment in the amount of roughly $20 million a year for the state of Minnesota. The total cost of this initiative over the 10-year period would be approximately $365 million. And as we indicated, that would be split, the responsibility for funding would be split between the state of Minnesota and the University of Minnesota. This next slide shows you how the Biomedical Sciences Research Facilities Authority, as we're calling it for the present time, would actually be constructed. It's a long-term strategy, as I indicated, with a long-term vision. The authority would be an entity of the state, would authorize $330 million in general obligation debt to support the program. The state would be responsible for roughly 90%, with the university responsible for 10% match. The university has very significant additional costs associated with this long-term investment. All the operating expenses on the buildings we're talking about, much of the long-term investment in research equipment, the hiring of new people, and the equipping of the laboratories. The authority would also establish a statutory transfer of revenues on a schedule sufficient to service the bonds and support a project, as I indicated, once every 2 years. The argument that we're advancing is that the university and the state of Minnesota cannot be competitive in this area without a long-term strategy. You need a long-term predictable plan. It cannot be funded strictly by the current bonding cycle. I must point out we funded, as a part of the university's investment, two buildings in the past four bonding cycles, and this is not a schedule or a strategy that will put predictability in the equation and allow us to be competitive for the long haul. The next slide gives you presents a schematic diagram of how the Biomedical Sciences Research Facilities Authority would work. On the left-hand side of the diagram, we're asking that the legislature, through its action, with the support of the governor, establish the and create the Biomedical Sciences Research Facilities Authority, and authorize the necessary debt to make it successful. And along with that, to enact a statutory transfer of state revenues to retire the debt, as Representative Abrams has outlined in his remarks. On the right side of the diagram, this schematic shows how it would operate. The authority would accept applications in accordance with the goals of the program. It would approve financing. You see the formula that I've just mentioned in the two boxes below. And you see down in the lower right-hand corner of the diagram what the projected revenue transfer schedule might look like up until 2016, and thereafter, after 2016, obviously over some period of time, the annual expenditure would ramp down. We can give you much more details on the cash flow in this model if you would find that helpful. So that's just a quick, Representative Norna, so that's just a quick walkthrough of the proposal, the heart of the proposal, and we'd be very pleased to take your questions at this time. But I'd like Dean Powell to just take a couple of minutes to tell you from her point of view why this proposal is so critically important to the future of the university's medical school, the biomedical sciences research that we do not only in the medical school but in other colleges on the Twin Cities campus, and why it's so critically important to the state's future. Dean Powell.
Welcome to the committee. Would you identify yourself for the record,
yes,
please?
I'm Deborah Powell. I'm the Dean of the Medical School at the University of Minnesota. Chairman Nornes and members of the committee, I won't take very much of your time. I simply want to echo everything that President Brunix has said and try to emphasize how important this is for the medical school. The medical school at the University of Minnesota is responsible for more than a third of the research dollars that come into the University of Minnesota. And so for the University of Minnesota to be successful in its endeavor to be one of the top three public research universities in the world, the medical school must be successful. For us, it boils down to faculty, facilities, and predictability. We have to be able to recruit outstanding faculty who will bring new research programs to Minnesota, and we have to keep the outstanding researchers that we already have. We've tried to focus on some areas in which we already have strength and which are extremely important to the health of the public in this country. Neuroscience, heart disease, cancer, infectious diseases. Minnesota already has strength in these. but we are under intense competition from other states to hire the best people. We are at the present time trying to recruit a new director for our cancer center, and we are very proud of the comprehensive cancer center that has received National Cancer Institute funding thanks to John Kersey and other dedicated scientists at the university. But the first candidate that we've interviewed has already turned us down, and we are trying very hard to bring in an outstanding leader for this cancer center. And they always ask me, where will the research they see? At the same time, we are trying to hire a new director for our division of cardiology who will also head the Lohai Heart Institute and carry on the traditions of Walt Lohai and the research group that was here at Minnesota 50 years ago. And again, they ask me what space is going to be available for research. So when we want to recruit the best, we have to put them in the best places. And I think Minnesota deserves this. Project, which is, I think, very visionary, will give us the facilities and, most importantly, will give us the predictability so that I can say to these people, yes, there will be space and this is the plan. This legislature has been extremely generous to the medical school, and if it weren't for the assignment of the tobacco dollars several years ago, we would not have the funds to hire people. We recycle those dollars to bring in physician scientists. So to me, this is the next step, and we are asking for your help again.
Dean Powell, if I recall, you were recruited from Iowa, is that correct?
No, from Kansas, but you're
Kansas.
Close.
Okay. I'm going to go south of here.
You were, yes.
Everything is south of here.
We have a question, or a couple questions, I guess. Representative Carlson, your first.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, this is a question maybe of the university, if they researched it, or Representative Abrams, who's learned it in law. The question I have is, can we legally bind future legislatures when we talk about the statutory transfer? I personally like the goal of the bill, but I think that's maybe a question that needs to be answered from a legal perspective, because that's one thing we're often told, always told, about the binding of future legislatures.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Abrams.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, this is no different than passing a capital investment bill, because what is in here is general obligation bonds. So once the bonds are issued, it becomes a general obligation of the state of Minnesota. What the structure here is, as I understand it, is the authority would have $330 million worth of issuance capacity over a 10-year period. And once the bonds are issued, they're gone. Now, you get into the accountability question, which I think is an important question, and there's multiple layers of accountability here. Number one, if the university or the bond authority goes forward with a project or two and the legislature doesn't like it, you can repeal any future issuance of debt. That's the ultimate layer of accountability. Secondly, the legislature does elect members of the Board of Regents. And if this becomes an issue, I would suspect that you and others will ask members of the Board of Regents questions during their election process. And third, the university, for better or for worse, will be before the legislature every year looking for funding and other aspects, and are accountable for the dollars that are appropriated to the university, and would be accountable under this bonding authority for how these funds are ultimately expended. I point out that the governor would be making four appointments. There would be the fifth would be the commissioner of deed, and then there would be four legislators, one from each party in each house, who would be on the authority. So there's multiple levels of accountability. There's multiple points at which if the legislature didn't like the direction that this was taking, in which the legislature would have effective oversight over this program.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I wasn't totally clear with the question, because we're talking here, I think it, and maybe it's in part the way it's being presented, but with the capital investment, we determine the debt service each biennium. Mm-hmm. And what, looking at the overhead and a quick glance of the bill, we're talking here now what appears to be an automatic statutory transfer, and that's why I'm asking in terms of the legal footing that, that we're on. It appears on the face of it to be slightly different than our traditional approach to bonding in terms of the way we handle debt service. And my tendency, by the way, is to be supportive. I just want to make sure we're on appropriate legal footing with what appears to be an automatic transfer and how it would bind future legislatures. And our former chief fiscal analyst is before us. He's the one I would have posed this question to a few years ago as a House member. So university hires good people.
Please identify yourself.
Members of the committee, Richard Fitzroy, I'm the CFO and treasurer of the University of Minnesota. I do not have a law degree. I have a philosophy degree, but not a law degree. I'll defer to the lawyers. On the issue of binding a future legislature, I mean, you can never bind one. The only true binding is a constitutional amendment where you can't, that's pretty hard to undo. The legislature could come back, as Representative Abrams said, you can come back and undo the bonding authority and undo appropriations that haven't been spent or committed for debt service. This bill was looked at by bond counsel, and they didn't have any issues with the bill. So mechanically, we had it reviewed, and mechanically it didn't have any problems.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to make sure we're on sound legal footing the way it appears, and the proponents seem to feel that we are. I guess I know that in response to...
We do have one lawyer in the room.
Well, you got one at the table.
We got back
to... You know, we have made long-term commitments informally as well. I remember a number of years ago we wanted to get the faculty caught up with salary, and we agreed with the faculty to do it over a period of time, and we adjusted the appropriations for salaries at 2% a year over a period until we reached a certain benchmark. But we didn't put it in statute. We just sort of informally agreed, and by the way, under both parties, we always made that commitment, but it was an informal commitment. We didn't have an automatic escalator, if you will.
Welcome to the table. Would you like to identify yourself and add some 2 cents?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, I'm Fred Morrison. I am a professor at the law school. I sometimes teach Minnesota constitutional law, even, which is a rare subject. And about 25 years ago, I was the research director for the Constitutional Study Commission, which was involved in the complete revision of the state constitution. And I know the doctrine to which you are referring, which is one legislature cannot bind another one. And what that means is that this legislature cannot force the next legislature not to repeal the law. But this legislature can enact a law that creates an agency that has bonding authority over a period of time. You've done it many times, the Housing Finance Authority, the Higher Education Finance Authority, and so on. You could always appeal those. It doesn't affect any bonds that have been issued. Those become permanent obligations of the state. But you can give that authority for years in the future, subject to your revocation of it, and that's all that's being done here.
Mr. Chairman, that apparently answers the question. Thank you.
Representative Pulaski?
Mr. Chair, this is either for Mr. Berg or the university. It deals with the amendment on the funding stream. Where does the money that we're dedicating through 2015 from the tobacco fund, where does that go now?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Berg, Representative Pulaski, those payments go to the state general fund.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Berg, we'd be leaving holes in our budget out of those numbers each of those years that would have to be filled. So that is of some concern, by the small concern. Unless we would take it from the university's budget to fill it, that might be a...
That would be a very big concern.
That would not be the way you prefer us to fill this particular budget. My other question deals with the line that Representative Carlson was going down. Do we have an entity like this anywhere else in the state of Minnesota where the legislature gives up its bonding authority to another entity to issue bonds? The university probably can't answer, but maybe Ms. Novak or Mr. Burton.
Who's going to handle that? Mm-hmm. Ms. Novak?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Klowski, I don't believe the state of Minnesota can give up its authority to issue bonds. Only the, it's my understanding that only the Commissioner of Finance can actually issue the bonds.
Then
Mr.
Chair, Ms. Novak, it's poorly phrased, but in essence what's going to happen here is these bonds are going to be issued without the legislature passing a specific bill to issue the bonds except for the authority of this entity to do so. So do we have another entity like that that we give blanket authority to over a period of time to issue bonds?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Polsky, I have just recently been looking into this and I haven't found an authority or a commission or a board that has kind of long-term continuing authority to approve projects without coming back to the legislature for specific bonding.
Representative Abrams?
The closest analogy, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Pawlowski would be, as Professor Morrison mentioned, the Housing Finance Agency. What they have are revenue bonds in there, I've carried legislation because there's some federal limits on revenue bonds that can be issued. And that is open and standing until we have changed the allocation. The federal government gives us an allocation of how many bonds we can, how much in dollar value in bonds that can be issued. And between MHFA and HESO and a couple of others, we allocate that limit. But those are revenue bonds. They're not general obligations.
Mr. Chair, the distinction is interesting. It's revenue bonds, but it's also federal, isn't it?
Mr. Chairman, no, they're not federal. They're tax-exempt bonds.
They're tax-exempt.
And as part of the Tax Reform Act of 1988, or 86, excuse me, there were caps placed on the ability of states to have this sort of obligation issued. And that limit, it changes by congressional action from time to time. Hence, there are occasionally in the public finance bills something dealing with the limit for these agencies, and they are revenue bonds. They are not general obligation bonds. And
Mr. Chair, one more question.
Representative Pawlowski.
The bonding capacity here, and I was looking at your PowerPoint, this would go against the state's bonding capacity and general obligation bonds, not against the university's bonding capacity. Is that correct? So what we're building in here is a automatic reduction in our ability to bond with whatever you're doing in this bill. Is that correct, or did I misinterpret that?
Representative Abrams?
Mr. Chairman, the way I would put it is that if this bill passed, it wouldn't be $330 million against our bonding capacity. It's a question of what is issued. If the question that you're asking is, are we limiting in the future, assuming that the criteria are met and the bonds are issued, are we limiting the informal 3% limitation, which I would argue, and I would think that Mr. Fitzenreiter would probably agree, is becoming more of a myth than a reality as far as how bond houses view state finance. But if the question is, if the 3% were real, are you somehow limiting that in the future only when the bonds are issued? And the reason that that's an important distinction is that if the program isn't going according to the way that the legislature wants to, there are a number of ways in which the legislature can stop the program and you'll be able to get it back.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abrams, and the point is this year, let's say we were doing a $900 million bonding bill and the university had committed $100 million already out of this fund, would we then reduce our amount by $100 million because the university had committed in the bioscience program $100 million in bonding?
Mr. Chairman, members, there are five debt policy guidelines of the state. One of those, the one that you all hang your big hat on, is that the general fund appropriation for debt service should not exceed 3% of net non-dedicated revenues. You can decide as a matter of policy, and it's a policy question, whether the first building in this, of these theoretical 5 should apply against that 3% limit or not, and whether each subsequent one applies or not. I want to point out that there's another countervailing argument, and it's up to the finance department, legislators, and others how you want to treat it, that this proposal does open the Pandora's box about whether dedicated funds fall into the first guideline of the state, the 3% guideline. And I cite as an example, if you're going to move motor vehicle excise tax revenue to another fund that wasn't the general fund, does that count against the 3% when you issue debt against it? We're doing a similar thing here. Somebody can argue that point. We're not out to skirt the 3% guideline. We're out to point out that we need long-term planning. That's what this bill is about. But people are on either side of that issue.
Well, Mr. Chair.
President Pulaski.
And I'm just trying to get clarity. That's just an issue here with me. Let's assume that you come before us with your bonding request. Now, are we going to have the university classic bonding request, the Minsky bonding request, and then this entity's bonding? It wouldn't even be a request because you could do it without us. So are we going to see three different columns now rather than two? And then does the third column, how does that impact the university in any way when we're deciding on how much to give them in capital? I mean, should we count that in some way? Should we say that the university got a $70 million building out of this fund, but on the other hand, they're asking for $150 million worth of buildings over here? Should we, how do we balance that out with the Minsky side, which doesn't have a fund such as this?
President Brunitz.
Chair Narnes, Representative Pulaski. I think the first point I would make is that this is a completely transparent process. The purpose here is to recognize some extraordinary responsibilities the university has and some extraordinary obligations to serve the state's need in this needs in this particular area. Let me just speak hypothetically. We believe, based on our analyses, and they're firmly rooted in I think some cold hard facts, that this state needs to invest in its core infrastructure to support biomedical sciences research. The state can decide not to do that. It can decide to sort of sit out what I think is going to be one of the most exciting revolutions for the next 100 years. Now, everybody comes before you and makes that kind of argument, obviously. So you have to pick and choose the arguments that have hold the most water. But this is a place where the university has a role and responsibility that no other agency in our state performs. To do this cutting-edge research, to reduce childhood leukemia from roughly a 20% survival rate to what is close to 80% today. Much of that has taken place through the extraordinary work of the University of Minnesota. And I would argue that this requires kind of an extraordinary view of how we invest in the state's future. Now, we are going to come, we have 30 million assignable square feet that we operate, or close to that, every year, some of the oldest buildings of the state. So I'm not going to sit here and tell you we're not going to bring forward a bonding request, but I will tell you if we try to bring forward bonding requests that fully account for what we believe this state needs to invest in this area, 70% of every bonding bill between now and the next 10 years will be devoted to a single investment in this area. And the argument I would make is that that's not a sustainable strategy to support the academic programs of the university, and it's clearly not a sustainable strategy to support the research infrastructure of our state.
Well, Mr. Chair, President Brunitz, the question wasn't the validity of what's going on here. The question was, how is this going to be presented to the legislature, and how is it going to look when there are two columns for the University of Minnesota versus one for Minsky? Now, we have to address all of higher ed, and I'm trying to understand that if you come with your traditional request, is there going to be another column with what this fund generates in building over that same time period, so that we understand what the university is doing with this fund of money, which, by the way, is still state money. It's not the universities, it's the states. So I'm trying to understand how we're going to view it how I would view it as a legislator that's responsible for all of Minnesota, the university and the Minsky system. Are we going to have two columns here? The one column of this fund, the classic request, and then Minsky's. Is that how this would look?
President Berman.
Chair Narnas, Representative Pulaski, the one thing you can count on is this process will be highly transparent. You'll know every dollar that's going into the Biomedical Sciences Facilities Authority, how it's being spent, and what the return on the public investment is, and you'll be seeing that at the same time you see the biannual capital request.
But Mr. Chair, yeah. President Brunitz, what you're telling me then is this, that I should not count whatever's in this fund against your classic bonding request. Is that a fair...
No, that is not a fair characterization of what we're saying. I think what we're saying here is that this is a proposal to develop a long-term investment strategy in an area that is absolutely critical to the future of the University of Minnesota and the state. We are further arguing that this is the best way to do that, a way that will allow us the kind of predictability to keep and recruit the very most talented people that are necessary to sustain this kind of work. It's not an attempt to engage in any subterfuge or hide any particular money. You can count this money in three columns or two columns or however you want to count it, but it does establish a long-term, predictable strategy for investing in the future of biomedical research in the state of Minnesota. And I would argue that's absolutely critical to the future of our state. And I do think it is appropriate from time to time to talk about the mission of our respective institutions and to reflect on whether as some of us have some extraordinary responsibilities that require some extraordinary attention. I would argue this is one of them. I think we can handle all the major bonding issues of the University of Minnesota, the capital bonding issues through the normal process. I do not believe we can sustain a long-term investment strategy in this area without something that goes beyond the current biennial bonding request. There just isn't enough predictability in that strategy, I think, to get Minnesota to the position that I think is being achieved by states all around us. Now, this is a choice. It's a policy choice. We can simply make that choice. I think it's our responsibility to really argue for what the trade-offs are, for the long-term trade-offs are for the state of Minnesota.
Any further questions?
I don't know. I'm trying to digest transparent, but I'll get there.
Representative Lance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. President Jennings, you understand probably from the series of questions you just faced that there will at least be some pushback, if you will, from this committee perhaps and from other places as against the class of bonding request of the university when whatever form the information is presented to us, columns side by side or any other means. And you've already made clear that that it would not be sustainable to bump all of the classic bonding requests in favor of this because that would in other ways harm the university's mission. And so at least to some extent you're seeking additional bonding ability, authority, finances to accomplish this extraordinary purpose in addition to what you would ordinarily come to this legislature for. But you understand and are willing to take the risk, if you will, that there will be at least some pushback, and this debate will probably occur every time we come up as to what the appropriate balance is, factoring in however we want to the additional bonding that's related to biosciences.
I would only add that Representative Latz is speaking as one individual of this committee. You know, when you're making predictions,
Mr. Chairman, I'm not saying that I'll be the one giving the pushback. I'm just for clarity, as I'm trying to understand the testimony, there will probably be some questions raised down the road about that as we balance this out. And I guess the question is, are you willing to take that risk as we move forward? And so we're doing all that with our eyes open.
Yeah, Chair Narnas, Representative Latz, I think there's a bigger risk in not acting in a planful and strategic way as a state and as a university. So let me just make that point. I fully expect that whoever comes and makes the presentation of the university's needs in the future, whether it's yours truly or someone else, is going to have to make that case each time. And I would also argue that people are not going to be, that is, this authority is not going to be issuing any approval for bonds unless the case is made, and made rather persuasively, that this expenditure is in the state's best interest, and that there's a reasonable expectation of receiving a strong return on the state's investment. So it seems to me both of these mechanisms require continuous accountability. The legislature has continuous opportunity to review and set its priorities, and everything is transparent in this process. What is different is I think the state is reflecting on its current situation, the competitive nature of our world, the direction of science in this area, the importance of being competitive, not just nationally but globally, and making a conscious effort that this is a priority for Minnesota's future. The advantage for the University of Minnesota, obviously, and I think for the state of Minnesota, is more long-term predictability. Let me just give you an example. We, and Dean Powell could give you much better examples, but I'll give you this one. We just finished hiring a researcher from the University of Kansas, former colleague of Dean Powell, by the name of Gunda Gheorghe. She is one of the top medicinal chemists in the entire world. She does drug design mostly in the areas of neuroscience and cancer research. It took 2.5 years to hire her. It took 2 floors of a building to outfit her laboratory for the people who will be coming with her, or the people who will hire. You need that kind of long-term predictability if you want to be a player today. You didn't need it 20 years ago or 30 years ago, but you absolutely need it today. So I think this is kind of a very critical time in the state's history. Our analysis tells us that we can come here every 2 years, but hiring Dr. Gheorghe is going to probably take 6 years rather than 2.5. And if it takes 6 years, I think over time Minnesota will simply be out of the game.
Another question, Representative Lance.
Just a follow-up comment, I guess, Mr. Chairman. President Brunings, I think that we ought to be approaching this in a couple of ways. Frankly, I would carve this out completely independent of the classic bonding requests of the U, for all the reasons that you've already stated. And part of that is because, as I understand it, you know, we're a very conservative state fiscally in terms of our 3% cap that we've been utilizing as a policy, that most states and the bond houses don't even really get concerned until you're closer to 5%. And that's, I may be wrong, and this is not my area of expertise, but from what I've been reading, that's what I'm picking up. And that we've got lots of excess bonding capacity fiscally in the state of Minnesota. And whether that gets used as against the motor vehicle excise tax to, if that amendment passes in the fall, to fund more highways and transit and bridges, or whether that gets used for this kind of an authority, it seems to me we're not doing any harm to the taxpayers of Minnesota if we do that. So I think we ought to carve it out separately and let it go on its own and set up the structure so that we're confident that the decisions will be made responsibly, and then return to our usual classic bonding analysis, such as it is every 2 years or every 1 year, whatever it's going to turn out to be.
Members, I understand that our Representative Abrams, you're presenting this bill, or you have to leave by 1:30?
No, I'm here. I'm here for
who has meeting. Someone has to leave?
I think I have to leave.
You have to go to the Senate. Okay. What I'm saying is we'd like to conclude this. So we have two more questioners, and we're pretty good. Real short. Representative Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Abrams and President Brunix, I appreciate you bringing this forward. I think the forward planning is really what this is all about, and I trust the legislature can wrestle with how we want to account for things. My question, probably to Representative Abrams or maybe Mr. Berg, is the amounts remaining in the tobacco settlement payment. We've got them listed here, and they're in an increasing amount, and I right off the top of my head, I don't remember what they are. I trust that they're sufficient to meet these amounts.
Who has the answer to that?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there is currently $175 million a year deposited into the general fund from these annual tobacco settlement payments. Those go on. There's a formula, but they basically, until people quit smoking, will go on forever.
Thank you.
Representative Eastland.
Hear that, Lance? Right.
Thank you, Chair.
Sure. President Brunix, right now, what is the, maybe we've talked about it, I just didn't catch it, but what is the split of the revenue that comes into the university that is used in research and by in this area, and from private and public sources?
Chair Norris, Representative Eastland, if you take the total grants and contracts that we compete for, basically, that roughly is at $560 million this year. We estimate that over $300 million of the $560 is in some way related to biomedical sciences. The other thing I would say is that much of the work, a good deal of the work in this area also creates new discoveries, new patents. The University of Minnesota, for example, was recently evaluated for the promise of its patent pipeline by an international journal called New Scientist, and it was rated as the fourth best in the world. So I think this is also an area that is not only important for the prevention and the treatment of disease, but also, I think, in terms of creating new ideas and new products that can find their way into Minnesota's economy and quality of life. But it's a very, very big part of what defines the research success and the research portfolio and the research profile of the University of Minnesota. Now, if one were to add the competitive grants and contracts going to Mayo Clinic, and associated with the University of Mayo partnership and beyond, you're adding probably another $200 million. And so when you add this up, you're talking about $500 million of very serious research activity that keeps Minnesota on the forefront of medical discovery and application.
And Mr. Chair, and how does that split that money coming from private sources versus
Chair Narnes, Representative Eastland, I have a chart here that we can share with you. Most of the money comes from the federal government, and most of it from the National Institutes of Health. And we have it broken down here. For example, the National Institutes of Health, in terms of the $561 million, and there's an interesting chart here, would be $237 million this year. The National Science Foundation, about $54 million. A lot of that is in the area of biomedical research. Then you have much smaller amounts in other federal agencies, but the business and industry portion of this is roughly $52 million. So if you add all the other non-sort of federal, might be $100 million, a little less than 20% of the total. Now, I would add that we expect to see a substantial increase over some period of time in private activity, private gifts, private contributions, as well as public-private partnerships in this area. But it'll be some time before that number even comes close to competing with federal resources. I expect it'll never get there, quite honestly.
Mr. Chair, one comment. I guess the issue that I'm trying to put a finger on is the whole issue of biomedical science is a huge portion of the stem cell research is in there, and there's lots of controversy about stem cell research, and there are some restrictions about what research dollars can be used for, if they're publicly generated, and what they can be used for if they're private.
Right.
I mean, and that will can and will become an issue, I think, here. Does the university have any position on the kinds of research that it is going to fund and is going to promote and have happen on these state-funded buildings? I guess is kind of the way I would state it.
Dean Powell? Or?
Yeah. Chair Narnes, Representative Eastland, let me just say one thing, and then Dean Powell is in a much better position to give you a more detailed answer. only, I think, a small percentage of what we would define as biomedical research would be in any way related to embryonic or adult stem cell research, and I think that's roughly accurate. But we have very detailed policy protocols to govern how we conduct our research, and she can elaborate on those.
She doesn't have to do it at this point. Yeah. I just wanted to bring it up as an issue that I think the legislators are going to want to know more about.
Mm-hmm. Representative Abrams, would you like to renew your motion?
I will renew my motion that House File 3268 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Jobs and Economic Development.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? House File 3268 passes.
I'll get you copies.
Members, I'd like to very quickly look at the minutes. First of all, March 15th, we need to approve the minutes from that meeting. Anyone? Okay, Representative Carlson moves the minutes March 15th. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Then those minutes are approved. Minutes from March the 20th, we need those approved as well.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Cox moves the minutes from Monday, March the 20th. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. Representative Seifert, good to see you.
Hi, Mr. Chair, and back again.
And you would like someone to move?
I'll move it, Mr. Chair.
House file.
There we go. Mr. Chair, this bill would get referred to the Education Policy Committee. They're planning on hearing it Tuesday, and then it would go to the General Register. They're going to just make deadline.
Okay. Who made that motion to?
Mr. Chair, I'll move it.
House File 3252?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Proceed.
Mr. Chair, members, this bill is a result of being contacted by quite a few different high school teachers, principals, superintendents, and regular people out in western Minnesota who have taken advantage of getting post-secondary courses offered in the 100, mainly 100 and some 200 levels in their high schools in western Minnesota. To give you an example, I don't know if I have someone can hand these around. Benson High School, not in my district, did a brochure that I'd like to share with the members about the Challenge Program, which is offering college courses at the high school. On the inside, you'll see some testimonials from students. You'll see one is going to U of M Crookston, one is going to Concordia, one is going to Augustana, and one is going to Southwest Minnesota State, so they kind of have a sampling of public-private scattered around. But generally how this program operates is the universities will contract with the high school. They will have a faculty mentor assigned to the person delivering the instruction. The students who are in the courses who are taking it for college credit have to meet PSEO requirements, and the classes are held to a 100 or 200 level in terms of the rigor that's offered. This has been a program that's been around in western Minnesota for, I believe, about 10 years. You can see the courses that are offered at Benson High School include Composition 1 and 2, Pre-Calculus 1 and 2, Intro to Sociology, Psychology 1 and 2, French 3 and 4. And frankly, in a lot of the small rural schools of western Minnesota, I know of over 50 different sites where there are courses being offered mainly to seniors and some juniors where they are able to earn college credits. You'll notice in the inside of the brochure on the top that Benson High School in the last 3 years, juniors and seniors earned over 1,200 college credits attending Benson High School. And the bill before you, we've had some Minsky policy that has come up as of late that would require the high school personnel who are delivering the instruction over the next 2 years to get minimally a master's in the subject area. In some cases, we have people who have a master's in education who are teaching Comp 101, but they've been an English teacher for 20 years and so forth. My understanding is that at a lot of these sites, these will just simply shut down, that the high school teachers do not get paid any extra for delivering the college coursework. They're doing this out of the goodness of their heart, and they have extra time put onto their schedule because they're meeting with college faculty to make sure they're delivering the coursework properly. They have extra paperwork that they have to fill out and so forth. And a lot of them, if you have a master's in education but you're teaching Comp 101 as an English teacher, you know, frankly, they're not going to drive from Benson to the U of M or wherever they're supposed to go to get a master's in English. They're just going to drop the whole issue. Minnesota has been innovative in education on a bipartisan level. Going all the way back to the Perpich days, we've championed things like open enrollment, PSEO, college in the schools, IB, AP. And I really see this policy as shutting down a lot of opportunities for rural students. If the committee has any questions on how it operates, you know, there may be some people in the audience that would like to testify. But I have heard from many principals and superintendents in rural Minnesota that said it's delivered at a better price. It's delivered in the high school, so you don't have people driving to the U of M Morris or to Southwest Minnesota State, Marshall, or Moorhead State. You end up with a brain drain when you have sometimes PSEO students who are picking up and leaving for the whole day or for the afternoon. In this case, they're staying in, you know, the school, exercising leadership, and we're getting some of these challenging courses available. And we've had everybody from Bill Gates to the governor and beyond saying that we need to have more rigor in our high schools and make the senior year more meaningful. And this would be going opposite the direction of what I think the legislature has really been pushing the last, say, 15, 20 years in innovation. With that, I know I have Mr. Kite here who would like to say a few words on behalf of the bill, and then I'm sure Minskew and some others would like to come forward as well.
Mr. Kite, welcome to the committee. If you would identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you very much. I'm Charlie Kite, and I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, longtime school superintendent in the state, and essentially represent the school superintendents in Minnesota. Representative Seifert did a really good job just kind of explaining what was going on here, but we're very concerned. We've had a long-term goal in Minnesota of trying to accelerate the academic learning of our students. We've done that through PSEO. We've done that through advanced placement programs, international baccalaureate programs, and what we also call the concurrent college programs in the high school, which our representative is referring to. And these programs are going very well. And remember, it doesn't only accelerate the academic learning of the 11th and 12th graders. That, in turn, accelerates the courses that are taken by the 9th and 10th graders, that accelerate the courses that are taken by the 7th and 8th graders. So the goal here is to get as many of our academically able students to move along as far as they possibly can in this endeavor of education. I will report to you that last night at the Rochester School Board meeting, there were a large number of parents there who received facsimile fake checks from the school district in a total of $196,000 for the, which represented the tuition those parents would have paid at the college level, but instead the students took those courses at the high school level. So we see that as a positive development. Now, if you're a faculty instructor, you might not see that as such a positive development, but overall we think it's a good thing that's going on. Many of the high school teachers have master's degrees in either curriculum instruction or in some kind of technology for learning instruction, many of them having earned those degrees at the Minskew four-year colleges in their graduate schools of education. These are skilled teachers. They are fully capable of teaching freshman level, maybe even sophomore level college curriculum in their classrooms. And the policy change that was undertaken by Minskew, I kind of kept wishing they just sort of come and whisper to me before this testimony that they'd changed their mind and withdrawn it. That would have been so much simpler than doing this. But the policy change is going to significantly limit the supply of the teachers in our high schools that are going to be able to teach these courses. Because now the only teachers that would be able to teach going forward would be those that have not only the bachelor's degree in their license area, but also a specific master's degree in that area, plus specific credits even in addition to the master's degree. So we're going to find, therefore, a drying up of the concurrent classes. This is going to have a negative effect on the acceleration of academic learning, especially in rural Minnesota. And we would just like to ask you for your consideration of supporting this bill so that set of events doesn't happen, which I think is going to cause us some long-term unintended consequences in terms of the education of our children. I'd be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Representative Pawlowski.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Fink, can you tell me before Minsky put this policy in place, what they did with your organization or with the school districts that are involved to correct this perceived problem? Did they notify you? Did they work with you? And if so, what was their solution prior to having the policy put in place?
Representative Pawlowski and members of the committee, we've actually had a pretty good working relationship with Minsky on a number of things, but this one caught us by surprise. I frankly was not aware of this until about 48 hours ago.
Mr. Chair, you mean you were not aware of the policy being put in place until about 48 hours after they put it in place, or 48 hours ago from today?
Representative Pawlowski, from right now.
Well, Mr. Chair, so I guess the answer to my question is there was no effort on Minsky's part to work with either your organization or the school districts involved on whatever problem existed here. They simply put their policy in place.
Representative Pawlowski and members of the committee, I don't want to characterize it as in that negative a light. We do work on a number of different issues with Minsky, and many of our relationships are positive, but frankly, this one caught us by surprise.
Okay. Representative Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Cutter, I guess I'm going to follow up on what Representative Pawlowski asked. I'm trying to identify the problem here, and I have not had anybody talk to me and indicate that either that the Minsky or the university or wherever these students matriculate onto, that they haven't been prepared. I'm not hearing you say that. Can you? I'm still having a little hard time finding where the problem is that this is addressing.
Mr. Kite.
Representative Cox and members of the committee, probably true to my reputation of saying things too straight and getting into trouble every once in a while, I will say that it seems to me this has the smell, at least, of more about protecting adult jobs than broadening support for students and opportunities for students. I don't know quite all of the dynamics of it, but it seems to me that the more opportunities that we can put in front of our students for challenging academic courses, the better off we are. And the history we've had so far is the concurrent courses in the high schools have, in fact, been effective, and the students are being well prepared coming out of those courses.
Thank you.
Representative Erdahl.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Kite, I'm sure when Minsky comes up, we'll be able to maybe nail down the answers to some of the questions here a little more. I'm concerned or just wondering, and maybe displaying my ignorance here, about how the Minsky colleges make money from this. So now I understand that the students aren't paying extra money. Does the is a contract between the school boards and the colleges? Do they pay for those services? How does that work?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, basically a contract is worked out for the number of students who wish to take it for credit, and the school district will work that out with the university. And in every case that I can think of, it is delivered at less of a cost than if the student actually physically drove to a university. They are able to take advantage of economies of scale and so forth. The faculty mentors that work with the high school course delivery person, gets a little extra pay for the work that they're doing. But this isn't where the school gets billed 20 students times a PSEO rate. It's generally worked out on a contractual basis that's of a mutual agreement. And that's what I think the school administrators like, is that they keep their talented students in the school and they're able to work it out through a contract. And it's savings for the school, and you're giving the students opportunity, so it's a win-win.
Thank you. We have Joanne Roche, is it? From Minsky?
Thanks, sir.
Welcome to the committee, and identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Joanne Roach, and I represent MSCF, which is the Minnesota State College faculty. I've come to speak in opposition to the bill. Before I begin, I think it must be said for the record that the bill has an unstated intent, which itself I would like to address, and the wording perhaps inadvertently casts I met prior to Bradley, and Representative Seifert and I have had this discussion in the past. My first reason for being in opposition to the bill is that one of the major results of the bill is that it removes from one of the largest higher education systems in the nation the ability to determine the credentialing of faculty who do its work, the delivery of credit-bearing course material that completes academic degrees and that transfers both within this state and outside of this state. This ability is basically at the core of any higher education institution, and it forms the basis for its credibility both in this state and outside of this state. Reason number two, the faculty affected by the credentialing policy support the provision. I believe Education Minnesota has a representative here today which can verify what I have just said. I've been working on a task force with K-12 students and counselors and my colleagues, community college and technical college faculty and counselors since January, actually. We've gotten together to talk about our mutual concerns about the PSEO programs in both of the forms, delivered at the college and the college and the high school program, and to draft some needed recommendations for the improvement to the quality of the program. I would interject here that this is not about jobs. We are members of the same union. And the issues that we have talked about are quality issues. We are the practitioners. We are on the line. And frankly, we have some things to say about what is going on in this program that I think need to be said. The group has agreed that the main goal for the concurrent enrollment program needs to be to create as close as possible to a college experience, as possible as we can for students who are taking college courses in a high school setting. If you talk to a lot of the teachers who teach in this program, they will tell you that it is really impossible to truly replicate a college experience in a high school setting. And so as many of the elements of the college course as possible should be replicated to make these courses legitimate and not academic fraud. The core to the experience are faculty with the breadth of knowledge in the discipline to provide the coursework, the discussions, the assessment, and the exploration of a topic at a deeper college level, if we are giving college credit for the course. Reason number three, there are 35 of you signed on to this bill. We have Mr. Kite here today. This attests to the popularity of this program. But I'm telling you in Lake Wobegon that all is not well here. And even though for the purposes of this bill, I think we'd all like to believe that all of the children are above average, this is not true. I feel, maybe it's appropriate for Lent, kind of like the voice of one crying out in the wilderness here. So I hope that you will listen to me. For many college administrators with declining college enrollments, campus enrollments, for superintendents needing to hang on to per pupil funding, for parents with the cost of tuition staring them in the face, the dollar bill is the bottom line. So the program, incredibly popular because it is believed by many to be free, has grown with little comprehensive and consistent oversight, with no consistent measures of accountability and policy enforcement, with lack of attention to qualifying students appropriately, with disregarding of required assessment testing and course prerequisites, and with making policy exceptions the general rule. There is or has been no clear accounting for the revenue involved in the programs, and as many schemes for money changing hands as schools and colleges and universities involved in the program is what you're going to, some of you had a question just, well, maybe it was the last question about how the funding works for these things. You will find as many different explanations for that as you investigate colleges, schools, high schools working in this area. I've examined a collection of joint powers agreements working on this task force that I talked about earlier between high schools and colleges, setting the cost for individual college and the high school courses. They range anywhere from $300 a course to $750 a course to $3,000 a course. Ironically, the contracts which are the cheapest and undercut the others, I might add, tend to be from the greatest geographic districts. Since the cost of a course should cover the cost of the college mentor, one would wonder what kind of mentoring can take place for a class of students, a co-teacher, for $750 with, let's say, 150 or 200 or 300 miles distance from the college. Is this a legitimate college experience for students is what we're asking. Is this what the original legislation envisioned? Though the program is very popular, you as legislators need to be concerned about these issues. And frankly, a lot of us need a place to come with the concerns that we have about what's going on. My point is this. The practitioners in these programs, who, by the way, are rarely consulted, have much to say about improving the quality and the rigor and the legitimacy of the program. And some of those recommendations or future suggested improvements, locally or perhaps even from accrediting agencies, may be prohibited because the proposed legislation casts a net far too broadly. If you take a look at it, you see that the net that we're throwing out here captures far more than what is the, I would say, covert intent here. Policies for quality improvements, such as enforcing qualifying criteria for all students, enforcing mandatory placement testing, requiring that course prerequisites be met by high school students as they are met by mainstream college students, all will be illegal. As Minsky and the school systems now are finally beginning to take a look at this program seriously and to enforce or rewrite policy. I ask you not to tie the hands of those of us who work in these programs every day and have much to say about their legitimacy by passing this legislation. And finally, I'd like to take on the issue that is the reason for the proposed legislation. I know that there is at least one of you in this group who is going to ask me. So is requiring Ms. So-and-so, requiring more education of her, already an excellent high school teacher, going to make her a better teacher? And my answer to you and yours, your answer as well, being a number of teachers I see in the audience, and legislators who budget millions of dollars to education, is and ought to be yes. I teach. I believe that education improves our lives individually and collectively in innumerable ways. I work for and you fund an institution which literally sells that idea or that concept. Coursework imparts knowledge and skills that make us good at what we do and even better at what we do well. This is what we're asking. I would interject, there was a statement made before here that many of the teachers in this program already have master's degrees and would have to go back and get a master's in their area of expertise or in the discipline that they're teaching. That is not true. They need to go back and take what would probably equate to maybe four courses, those who already have master's degrees. And there are also a huge number of faculty teaching in this program who have bachelor's degrees, so we should clarify that. If we as educators and funders of education don't believe in our own product for our own teachers, then who will? So I urge you to vote against the bill for one or all four of the reasons that I've presented here today.
Thank you for your testimony. We have some questions, beginning with Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Roach, I appreciate your comments and couple of things that you had mentioned that I'd just like to pursue a little bit. I mean, what you, I think it was under your number three reason, you talked a lot about quality. Is there any tangible evidence out there that students that are coming through existing programs that are in small high schools around the state that maybe don't have a licensed professor teaching the courses are coming out less prepared on those courses? Are they performing at a lower level than if they would have been taken at an institution? Or
Representative Norness and Representative Eastland, we don't have research on that. The things that I can tell you And I apologize for that, but I think it speaks to the fact that we do need to do some research in this area, is anecdotal from the faculty who are involved in this program and from the mentors who are involved in the program. So our getting together and talking about this is, our intent is to ensure that there is quality and rigor in the program. From what we are experiencing from different corners of the state, but no, there is not research.
It would seem like if what we're trying to do is ensure quality, that we would first identify the fact that there is not quality now. I guess it would seem that there's something happening in a policy matter here that really has no justification in research, and it doesn't necessarily guarantee that there's going to be better quality. So I guess that was my first kind of reaction to what you had said. The second thing that you commented on was something about you can't replicate the college experience.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that what we're trying to provide kids is a college experience. We're trying to provide them with a college education. I see the college experience as being oftentimes very negative, quite frankly, personally. I think that there's that could be taken both ways. And I think what we're trying to do is provide an opportunity for kids to have a college education. And what this policy does at Minscu is it moves students farther away from that goal. If having a college experience is somehow is supposed to be an important part of what we do, maybe they ought to get some credits for it. I don't know. But the third issue I think what we look at here, at least what I look at as a legislator, is results. That's the way that we're trying to proceed in our K-12 system, and I think that's the way we should proceed in any place that we're spending state money to educate or provide education opportunities for our students. And I think if we're going to put our students in the best position to succeed, I think we have to put them in situations where there's proven track record of results. And I'm an author on this bill, and I appreciate Representative Seifert's efforts. If there's some issues, I think that's good. Let's talk about the issues. But let's talk about the issues before we make a sweeping policy that really takes away great educational opportunities for our kids. I think that's really the issue that is at the core of this whole meeting today, I think, and that's what I would...
Representative Norness, I would like to use your last slide. Before we make a law that basically prohibits any kind of improvements we might come up with from getting a group together to talk about this, as you're suggesting, is what I'm asking you not to do today. Because this bill would have that effect. I would also like to answer a couple of the other comments that you made by asking you a question. In your mind, what is the difference between a high school course and a college course?
In my mind, there are lots of things that we do in high school, and it's the content of the course. And if kids are taking the content of the course that would be receive a credit in high school or receive a credit in college, if they take it in high school, that should be fine.
But the content of the course should be deeper. We should investigate a subject matter more deeply when we're taking a college course, more widely. In my opinion, and I think that would be yours. So if we're just replicating a high school course, if it's just a certain amount of content, that doesn't make it a college course. That doesn't help people who are taking this course as the basis of their college education, their college English experience. This doesn't put them in the position that they should be in. And I think one way that we can at least have some degree of control over the content of the course is by ensuring that the instructor who teaches the course has a great understanding of the subject matter itself, or a better understanding of the subject matter itself. I don't want us to be accused somewhere down the line, and it eventually will happen, of academic fraud. I think if we're offering these as college courses and we're giving college credit, that we ought to do everything that we can to ensure that this is truly a college course, and it is a college experience. We cannot teach high school students some of the material that we can teach in a college course. I have to be very careful. I would have to be very careful teaching my American literature class in a high school. Modern literature tends to have some language and some subject matter that I could never teach in a high school. And yet for a student to truly experience American literature or modern American literature, that student should be exposed to that. This is what I mean about not being able to replicate the college experience. In college, students have to make a choice every single day whether I want to go to class or not, whether I want to get my money's worth from this course or not. In high school, if they don't show up, there's somebody calling home. And that's probably a good thing, and that's probably why parents really like this program. But I'm talking about things that make people deal with mature subject matter and handle themselves maturely and responsibly as being part of what I'm talking about here, as the replicating the college experience.
Members, just want to remind you, we have one more bill we'd like to get to today, too, and that's also...
I'll just say, you don't have to respond to this, but Ms. Roach, you said in your comments earlier that there is no data that says that if a student takes a college-level class in high school versus at a college, that there is any difference in the outcomes with that student. I mean, there is no data out there that says they're less prepared or they learned less because they took it in college. Or took it in high school. So, I mean, you can say all you want about what the college experience does, but clearly it has not demonstrated that it changes what students learn. And I think that's really the core of the issue here. Mr. Kite was up here, and I think he had a very interesting comment. He said he was hoping Minsky would come and talk to him before this meeting today so we could eliminate the meeting and go back to the table to discuss a more rational way to bring this proposal forward. I think those are the concerns that legislators have. Those are the concerns that I have, rather than some kind of a heavy-handed change in policy that affects lots and lots of students in our state. It would seem like if we're concerned about students and we want to put them first, that we would go through other means than just making a policy change and forcing the legislature to bring this issue to the table and possibly take some legislative action. That is not the best solution. A negotiated solution here would be much better, and I would encourage that approach if it's possible.
Representative Abrams?
Well, Mr. Chairman, when I saw this bill on the schedule, Representative Seifert, I said, is this Representative Seifert going off on the deep end again? But I can just talk about my kids in my school district. I don't know what's going on in Benson, Minnesota, or in Marshall, or with Minsky. I can talk about Benjamin Abrams and Alexander Abrams. Benjamin took college in the schools through the University of Minnesota French 5. He took AP courses, and he graduated with the equivalent of 32 college credits. He told his brother, and the AP were backed up by AP tests, all of which were 5 except in BCAP Calc, which was 4. He told his brother when he had a choice between taking French 6 or not, because he took French 6 at the university, that you should take French 6 in the college and school program because you get a better, more individualized experience. I can just talk about being a consumer here, Representative Seifert. I can't talk about the great issues of our day in these other school districts. I also challenge two other notions, that it necessarily saves you money because, at least in the case of Benjamin, and will be the case in Alexander, instead of taking one-level courses at the University of Minnesota and basically wasting their freshman year in some of those courses, they're going to take 4 years of courses at the university, but they're going to take more 3- and 5-level courses at the University of Minnesota. And they're going to get more value for their education because they got the content that they needed in high school. So, I can't talk about what's going on between Minsky and this program. I think it is a valuable program. But, I would really, if I were a parent and I were looking to send my kid to St. Cloud State or Winona State or one of the other fine state universities, and was being told that the college and the school program that is being offered in the Hopkins School District wasn't good enough for their kid to get college credits,
frankly, I'd be looking at if I didn't want to go to the University of Minnesota, I'd be looking at some other university outside the state of Minnesota that would take these credits, because I think that they're a good program, Representative Seifert, and thank you for bringing the bill forward.
Representative Cox?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Easton handled most of my questions, but I do have one last one, a very quick one, yes or no, to Ms. Roach, and that is when you have these classes at the high school, you have to have an agreement in place, and you have to review the content of the class before the class moves forward and it would accept students. Do you, I guess?
Yes, you are supposed to.
All right. Thanks. I thought so.
Representative Rudolph.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Roach, piggybacking a little bit on the Representative Eastland's question regarding if there were problems with quality regarding the instructors, wouldn't one way to measure that be the percentage that are having to take remediation courses? If that's a higher percentage than of other students who are not in this program?
Well, excuse our Representative Nornes. Students are only allowed in the program if they are in, for juniors, the upper 30% of their class, for seniors, the upper 50%. Now, that's the MNSCU guidelines. We've been looking, the task force that I'm working on is, which would be unable to enforce this if this bill becomes law, is looking at standardizing across the state how we qualify for this program and accepting the University of Minnesota's guidelines for that, which is you have to be in the upper 30% of your junior class and the upper 20% of your junior class and the upper 30% of your senior class. With regards to that, are dropping the standards down to 50%, you have to realize that senior class is sending us, when they come to college, 38% that need remediation. So I think the 50% is too low. As far as those who need remediation, they are not allowed. I guess I answered your question. They have to be in that particular percentage of their for this program.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Once again, it would indicate to me that if you had a high amount of students from this program taking remediation, that then you would have, you could measure a deficiency in quality of the instruction. But I don't know that...
They wouldn't have to take... They should have taken the assessment test already when they signed on to take one of these courses. So they wouldn't be taking it as they moved to the college. And that would determine whether or not they needed the remediation.
Just summing up...
Senator Berdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just summing up the feelings I've been getting as I've been listening to this, I mean, is the basic intent just to end this program?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
It is a good program, and we'll all acknowledge that. It is to keep it a good program. And in the absence of research, not to wait, perhaps, for research that was going to point out to us the problems that we have, but to constantly be honing the program into what we think it ought to be.
Representative Pulaski?
Mr. Chair, my question is to Ms. Novak, and it's just on whether or not this language works. On line 1.13, it says, must not adopt. My concern is, does this work? Does this make it retroactive? MNSCU has adopted it. Does this bill still apply in this case?
Ms. Novak.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Pulaski, this bill is prospective, and if they have, in fact, adopted the policy, and I'm not sure that they have officially adopted it at the board level.
Okay.
So it probably needs a retroactive effective date.
Mr. Chair, that's my concern. I think we should consider a retroactive clause here, just in case. So we don't need to do it today, perhaps, but that's my concern.
Mr. Chair, we have to go to Ed Policy Tuesday, so I think I'm very hesitant about anything retroactive, but I think we'll have to make the language work, obviously, otherwise it's not going to work. And this is planned on phasing in over 2 years, but you know, I certainly have concerns.
I think we have one more, maybe two questions. Representative Haas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would think that these types of items should be able to be worked out prior to making a strong policy or enforcing it with a law. I just think that both are really not the way to go. But if you take a look at what you've done, everybody at the table has probably done in high school and then where you went to in college. You were based on where you started out. And if that high school didn't offer you that standard, you got in a lot of trouble. So if you took and you go in this program, you take pre-calc and you get thrown in a calculus class and you don't have the basis for it, you're not going to like the high school very much. However, I can remember jumping into the calc classes with my high school classes. Period. And I don't see a lot of difference in this of accepting these as where you were going to start in college. But I would agree with the Representative Abrams. I still would have 4 years of college. It gives me a different starting point, whether I'm going into advanced French or if I'm going into advanced English or English. I'm accepting that some of the stuff I've done in high school puts me ahead a little bit. So I don't think it's really wiping out a year of college for anybody. I think it's starting people at different levels, and I think this should have been negotiated way a long time ago. So,
thank you. Representative Dempsey?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a concern I have is at least in the school that we evaluated our teachers. And I don't know if college professors would want to have me use their teaching methodology, because primarily if you've been in college, you know what teaching method is used by college instructors. And I can tell you from experience as a school administrator, and the school administrator, to be quite frank with you, is the one that determines who is going to be the instructor and whose kids are going to get that instructor. Teachers don't decide that. Administration does. Teachers are evaluated by instructors in some instances. Not in the public school, it's the school administrator. And there aren't many school administrators, I'll mention to you folks, in the state of Minnesota's legislature. And the members of this committee can take a look. How many administrators are there, school administrators, in the House? Two.
I was going to say, I didn't believe
that. And they do a lot of things that determine what the school is going to be like. And the primary focus on secondary education, ladies and gentlemen, is that all kids learn and all kids are somebody. And that's pretty noble work. That's why it's good to have good teachers. But I don't know the teaching method that they use at the university. I don't know that, because I don't evaluate them. But maybe you'll have 3 or 4 or 5, and who does the evaluation of that? I don't know.
Representative Dempsey? I don't want to cut you off, but I just wondering if there was a question.
No question. I just wanted to make a comment in regard to the lady that was talking about the courses and that kind of thing at the college level.
Thank you very much. Representative Pawlowski, would you like to renew your motion?
Yes, I would.
Motion to pass House File 3252 and refer it to the Education Policy Committee. All of those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? House File 3252 passes and moves on to the Education Policy Committee. Representative Seifert, you need something to hear 3252? Is that?
Mr. Chair, my next bill is 3169. I'll be very brief, but this is passed easily at the local government committee. It would be recommended to pass and go to the general register.
Mr. Chair, I move then.
Okay. Representative Conex moves, which number is it?
3169.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Present your bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is a preventative bill. This is not something that's happened yet. Last year, as some of you may have read in the press, there's a St. Paul City Councilman who had proposed some type of a fee or an assessment that would be charged against college students just because they're college students. Would not relate to education, but it would rather go to the local units of government. We had a lot of discussion in the local government committee about this as a policy, in that you would have a local unit of government going after someone just because of being a college student, but it wouldn't relate to their education per se. This has not been something that's been adopted in any city or county, but as I see local governments looking for money, I think most people on local government agreed that this would be an awfully easy chicken to be picking. You have people who are temporarily living in your ward, who have low voter turnout, who don't even know who their councilmen are, and suddenly we have, it was proposed that it'd be a $25 or $50 fee, and then all of a sudden it can be $75 and $100, and it's added onto the student fee statement, but not going to the university. And frankly, I just don't want to get us in the situation where we're going to have people looking around for dollars and fleecing college students just because they're college students. As I said, if we start the process, then the local unit of government gets addicted to the money, and then we're never going to have a policy to stop something like this. And although many of us worship at the altar of local control when it's convenient for us, and I'm one of them, this is a situation that I do think we need a statewide policy that just says you don't go after college students just because they're a college student. And in many cases, I think this is something where it's going to start out as a small assessment, and then it's just going to end up going through the roof, and it's going to be just too convenient to go after this student population. I think I had someone from the student association
in our audience
that were waiting patiently that wanted to testify, if they just wanted to give a very quick word, extremely brief. If you could come up. We did have someone here that was before local government did a very excellent job, but go ahead, guys.
Okay, welcome. Identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you. My name is Travis Reese. I'm the vice chair for the Minnesota State University Student Association. Representative Seifert covered most things that I was going to say, but I was just going to be, I can be brief in saying that we have a study that we look at that Minsky conducted that looked at the annual economic impact on the communities of the universities as well as the community and technical schools looked at, and the example that I pointed out, would like to point out, is the Metropolitan State University, being in the city of St. Paul. They contribute about $119 million to their local economy. And there are, each university, St. Cloud is about $390 million, Mankato is about $303 million. And so the schools are valuable. And the students pay rent, and they live in the houses and apartments. They shop, they eat, they work. They're valuable parts of the community. And I'll pass on to my colleague over here.
Thank you, Patrick.
Chair Nornis, my name is Patrick Christner, President of the Minnesota State College Student Association. Just to kind of piggyback off the previous two speakers, first off, this is one of our top three priorities as an association for this legislative session, and we strongly support House File 3169. And really, let's just call this what it is. This is a tax on students, not just a fee. we understand the thing. This is just another, fee that would be put to our debt load. And affordability is already a question. I think the honorable representative hit the nail right on the head. If you start off with $25 here, who says it won't be $100 later? And the economic and social impact that students bring to our communities is immense. I've spoke with many lawmakers in the last few weeks and about this bill, and people that don't, or some representatives and senators that don't have community colleges or universities in their districts, and they're totally for it, or totally for this bill, because they understand the economic impact. So I strongly urge you guys to, or the members to vote for. So, sorry.
You were right the first time.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if he wants to come up, but John Corbett is here from the Private College Council, and he did the testimony in local government. I don't know if you wanted, if you want a thumbs up, John, or...
Thumbs up, way up.
And, Mr. Chair, I know we're probably not going to have an omnibus finance bill per se, and this is one of the top priorities of student groups. Other than bonding, we should give them something this year. I did talk to some of the staff in the chair taxes. Between the title and the verbiage, the word tax isn't in there, and they didn't believe they needed to see the bill. We'll do a referral if they change their mind, but right now we feel local government and higher ed are good, and my friend Representative Abrams said he probably would let her go, I would think, so...
If I had the choice.
We'd go to the General Register, Mr. Chair.
This is real quick. Is that a... We got a go wave, or...
This is real quick.
Oh, okay.
Representative Berto.
Let's say, I just asked the witnesses if they had to call Representative Seifert to find out what color shirt to wear today. It was just an irony that we're all blue today.
They both have taken advantage of it. All right. Representative Cox, would you like to renew your motion?
I would renew my motion that we move on the bill.
As House File 3169 and place it on the General Register. All of those in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? House File 3169 heads to the General Register. And with that, our meeting is adjourned.